Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals it is once again 8 p.m. on Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? We are the only storytelling program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, with Floyd the Wonder Dog at my feet, roaming the studio, and along with the best team on radio, Drs. Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, and Hank Rubicek. And on the boards tonight, we have Tatiana Gago, our engineer extraordinaire. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers from every walk of life. Some tell their stories professionally from the stage, while others tell theirs for the very first time in our little studio. Each takes us on journeys as experienced through their own unique life experiences that transport us to magical worlds before returning us safely and gently to the present. We've had our share of veteran storytellers grace our studio over the years, but the team on So What's Your Story is especially proud of the role we play as an icon in community radio, reaching out to anyone with a great story to tell, and that may even be you. And if there's one thing we've learned from the increased popularity of this program and our flourishing Houston storytelling community, it's that stories need to be heard, just like those we're going to enjoy tonight. As long as you continue to support us, we will stay right here each and every Thursday night, bringing you the best storytellers in Texas. In fact, if you like what you hear on our little show, tonight is a great night to call 713-526-5738 and make a generous donation to let the powers that be know we have a passionate audience, and I know you are passionate about storytellers just like we are. We are nearing the end of our latest pledge drive, and contributions let everyone know that our audience supports the work we do and the stories we share. As an added bonus tonight, by calling in during this program, you can talk to my co-host, Warren Holloman, at no extra charge. And that, my friends, is a very real treat. If you'd prefer to contribute online, just click to kpft.org, select So What's Your Story as the program you'd like to support, and let the magic happen without ever having to talk to a single solitary soul. Tonight, we're going to be talking with a couple of artists, exceptional ones. They are in the studio with us, and my first guest is Robert Calafiore?
Yes.
All right.
Perfect.
Assistant Dean of Hartford Art School at the University of Hartford. He was born in Connecticut to Italian immigrants, which I don't know if it should, but it always makes me hungry. I just start thinking about amazing Italian food.
I'm hungry already.
He is a first-generation American and was the first in his family to attend college. After attending art school for both BFA and MFA degrees, he focused on his artistic practice while administrating, teaching, and promoting the fine arts internally and externally from a university and faculty position. You're going to have to explain that one to me. That's a mouthful. Currently, he lives and works in West Hartford, Connecticut, exhibiting his work nationally and internationally. Just Google him to find out recent reviews and articles of his work. He's absolutely everywhere, I'm telling you. And we'll have some links later on our page, you know, about some ways people can find you and see your artwork.
Terrific.
Crystal Ray is a Houston-based award-winning playwright and performer who calls Chicago home. We'll have to find out more about that. Her one-woman play, Nearest the Broken, was introduced to the world in Houston with its full-length premiere at the Ensemble's studio series. Sections of Nearest were also chosen to appear in three festivals in New York. That is amazing. I know how hard it is to get in one festival.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Her second one-woman show, Lions, was named the most purposeful play by Houston's Play on Purpose organization, which I didn't even know about, so you can tell us about that, too.
My pleasure.
Crystal has also written a number of shorts and screenplays. Her work is most often centered around the beauty of the African-American experience, real or imagined. Both of these guests live the life of an artist, and you'll get to know more about each of these terrific people and what made them choose the paths they chose as the programs unfold. So get ready for some fascinating human excursions through the eyes and souls of these multifaceted tellers. Crystal and Robert, welcome to So What's Your Story?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm really excited about this show. And Crystal, I'm working on my first full pledge play right now. So,
what's your story is the program you'd like to support.
Sorry about that little technical problem there. Crystal, let's begin with you. You call yourself a Houston Place playwright, yet claim Chicago as your home. What brought you to Houston, and what convinced you to stay?
I wanted to play with the big kids. Houston, for me, represented an opportunity to do art on a professional scale. And I had been living in Abilene, Texas. I love the friendly frontier. It is my home, about 6 hours west. It's where I went to college, my alma mater, ACU, go Wildcats, and had been doing radio there and did a little behind the scenes at some of the local radio local TV stations. And people were enjoying what I did, but I didn't know if it was because they were nice. I mean, Abilene is the nicest place to live. It is so sweet. It's always...
What got you to Abilene?
I wanted to study school in Texas, study in Texas, because I was born in Austin. So somehow that ended up being a scholarship to Abilene, ACU. And so I wanted to know if people were just being nice to me or if I could really do it on a professional scale. So I moved to Houston. It seemed like the right market to try it out.
What's one of the biggest challenges facing, you know, you as an artist moving to a town like Houston?
There are a lot of amazing opportunities. But there's also, you need to have a lot of gumption to put your feet in and try it for yourself. The ensemble theater is wonderful, and the outlets to do art are real. You have to want to put your sweat in order to make it happen, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I think one thing that surprises people that don't know Houston is when they find out that we are a major theater town, that we are a major storytelling town,
yes.
We're a major creative writing town.
Yes.
And because in another part of my life, I produce shows, I found out Houston actually has more theater seats than New York City, and they're full most nights.
And they're beautiful.
They are beautiful.
Like in New York, some of those spaces, you go into those spaces and you're like, okay, this is a closet, and you've shoved 50 chairs into this closet, and it's a scary closet at that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're beautiful. And yet the number of artists in here in the city make it so that the opportunities, if you want them, you have to kind of create them because there are only so many slots.
But you can create them.
And you can.
That's how I became a producer. I just decided to do it.
Come through. Just decided to do it.
I am a passionate supporter of adoption. And your first story is about one of the most famous adoptions in the history of the world. Would you tell us your story?
Yes. This is the story of lions. I tell the story from the viewpoint of Pharaoh's daughter and having adopted Moses. And so the particular scene we're jumping into, she is having one of the adoption people kind of look at her home and survey her life to see if she's a perfect person for this process. I take adoption seriously. And so although we as royals are exempt from a number of societal processes, I thought it'd be good to open my home to the little adoption people who come in and do the checks. You know, like, is your house clean? Does your child have their own room or adequate space? And how does the family work together? You know, that sort of stuff. Now, Mo had been ours since he was little, right? So we had this blended family thing down. So I expected Miss Clarice to, you know, give me a great report. Gold stars. All gold stars. You're doing a great job as a middle mom, Miss Clarice says to me. A middle mom? It's a little term I picked up along the way. I think of it as like a mom who takes care of kids that are in the middle of a crisis. Oh, right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Now, when will Moses be returning to his family? I beg your pardon? The regular documentation wasn't available for me to review, but I assume you're fostering, right? No, we've adopted Mel. Huh. I mean, you rescued the child despite orders.
She was sticks. Big bang theory takes place.
Given the current administration is kind of against young people of his particular pedigree, yet instill, and quite nobly and unprecedented, you step in on his behalf. You've raised him to understand his own family and heritage and background. He knows his own people's language. It seems as if you're ready to introduce him to his biological environment. No. I just wanted him to know the full breadth of who he is. For what, Your Highness? Because identity is important, which is my point, Your Majesty. How does Moses identify? As a royal or as an unpaid laborer? Look, from what I can tell, you're a great mom. Huh? The interaction between you and Moses, it feels authentic and healthy. I wish all my clients were as lucky and as happy as Moses is here. Quick story. I'll be fast. I had a goldfish, right? Kept them in a jug. Okay. It was about this big around. I dropped the jug one day and it cracked at the bottom. So I put the goldfish in a pot about 5 times as big. The goldfish doubled in size. I take that same goldfish. I put it in a horse trough. The goldfish grows as long as my leg. Do you see where I'm going with this here? Okay. Yes, Mrs. Clarice, I think so. So why would we try to shove Moses back into the jar, as you put it? I'm afraid, Your Highness, this is the jaw. I'm sure you know your way out, right, Miss Clarice? Thank you for coming. Yeah, no, anytime, Your Highness. Anytime.
Wow. What an amazing story. What a creative story. How did this idea come to you?
I have a Nearest and Lions are both telling stories of women that are in the Bible that I feel like I've glanced past, and I was just wondering one day, what was it like to have adopted Moses and have leveraged your resources to help, and it didn't quite work out as planned. I'm sure she had a plan. Every mom has a plan.
Wow.
And it didn't quite work out as planned for her. And yet, as planned for him. And I wanted to hear her voice. And that's what all these stories are about, is hearing, attempting to hear in a modernized way what these voices may have sounded like if they were sitting across from me at the table.
Well, you know, I absolutely love the idea of recognizing those who were unjustly looked over. And the New York Times started a series in the last year or so running obituaries, and I believe it's primarily of African Americans who they say obituaries that should have run in the New York Times but did not in their day. And so it's fascinating to go back and read about people that passed on 100 years ago that did fascinating big things, but nobody really paid much attention to at the time.
You are lighting candles in my life right now. That is amazing.
How have people responded to this story?
It's been across the board. I mean, the mom sensibility, it was Mother's Day, which was great marketing, right? But also bad because people wanted to be with their mommies. Mm. But the ones that came out, they latched onto the idea of what a mommy is willing to do on behalf of a son, even when it's difficult. Mm. And that's really the point of the piece, is the strength of moms and the different ways moms look, you know, the foster, the adopted, and the biological, and they all have a conversation piece within the show. So it's been going
the on. One thing I am certain that parenthood has good parenthood has nothing to do with is blood. You may be related by blood, you may not be, but it doesn't have anything to do with whether you're a real or good parent or not.
So true.
Robert Calafiore is a talented and very, very busy man, as we've established. He is both a working artist and a full-time professor and associate dean of art at the University of Hartford. So my first question for you is, it sounds like you have at least 3 full-time jobs that should all take 60 to 80 or 100 hours a week.
I think that's about right.
You juggle all this?
I wish I could clone myself, but the reality is I can't, and so it just takes an incredible amount of discipline, as you would expect, and organization, mostly just organization. Be on top of what needs to be done where for which job.
Serious question. Do you have a good assistant that kind of helps keep you organized?
I do. Yes, yeah. Not in all three of those jobs, yeah. But in a few of them.
And I think it's too hard to accomplish anything completely alone in this life, and having a good, you know, person you can count on to help you.
It's certainly not as rich doing it all on your own. You're enriched by the people around you and
yes.
the things that they bring to your work.
Yeah, and I've never had any great desire to accomplish some great thing alone. That just sounds like a really lonely victory party.
And pretty boring.
Yeah. You know, and I gain a lot from bouncing ideas off the people I trust and listening to their ideas. When did you realize that as part of your art, you were also a storyteller?
I think when I eventually started making photographs, I wasn't sure what I would do with those photographs, but I realized that although mine were much different than the things I'd been used to seeing, we think about photographs growing up as documents, right? It's the first sort of thing we go to. Photographs document our lives and our surroundings, and they tell stories and photojournalism. But I realized eventually, stepping back and looking at my photographs after a number of years of making them, that they also were telling stories, but not in the kind of same linear way, maybe, or narrative, descriptive narrative way that a documentary photograph tells a story.
I can absolutely relate to that because I grew up in a photography studio, and my father collected antique tintypes.
Oh, yeah.
And
beautiful.
I could spend hours sitting on the floor of the photography studio staring at these people, wanting to know their stories, wanting to know who they were. And, you know, the longer you spent with a picture, it did tell a story if you paid attention to the details.
And whether you have the story exact as the maker intended it to be or what it actually was about doesn't really in the end matter. It's what it gives you and it gives everybody something different.
It's kind of true of all art, isn't it?
I think so.
Your first story tells us a lot about your relationship with art. Will you tell us that story?
Sure. So I've been a maker from the very beginning. As far as I can remember, I've always wanted to make things. And at an early age, I thought I'd be an architect because my making always centered around building things, and I would build things out of any materials I can get my hands on. And eventually, you know, you go off to school and you have more access to things, and I get to high school and I'm pushed in the direction of photography by my art teacher, very influential at a young age. And it was because she saw something in the way I could communicate through those images. I didn't understand it yet. I definitely did not understand it. It took a long time, but that's where it got started. So I started making photographs. I went to art school. The art history, the technique, the materials, the equipment, you learn everything about everything that you possibly can. And then you're launched off into the world as a maker. And now what do I do? And what do I talk about? It's all about me now. No one's giving me an assignment. No one. And so eventually I start teaching part-time, and I've been doing that a long time. And then I start administrating, and that question you asked about the external, internal, and what does all that mean? Well, on a university campus, you would think, well, everybody knows about the art school on this campus or what the art department does. Not true. Mm. Oftentimes, they know just as little as maybe those on the outside. So I'm promoting the arts both to our internal audiences and external audiences. But so that teaching for such a long time gave me some really great insights into how students think and therefore how I was thinking when I was their age and making, right? So I can sort of start to pull from them after decades of doing it. But then what happened one day was I started to see some real shifts in the way students in the darkroom, in analog photography, pre-digital, right? It's how I grew up, but in my teaching, digital was already sort of part of the world. And so what I started to notice was the students coming in recently don't have the same skills in terms of dexterity. Their relationship to the physical world is completely different than mine. I grew up outside kicking balls, holding a baseball bat, hitting a ball, playing soccer, running around, getting all scraped up, going bowling. my students' experience of those things is on a flat screen. They're sliding their finger across a smooth piece of glass and throwing a ball down an alley.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationship to physical things is totally different. And it gets even more complex. Their relationship to each other and people has completely changed because the way they communicate with each other is changing. So I started noticing these differences. And in my early courses, from the beginning, I used a pinhole camera as a way of easily demonstrating how photography works, the kind of magic of photography. It's a simple box. You poke a hole in it. An image is transmitted through the hole to the back of the camera. I'd hand out the assignment with instructions. Students would go home. They'd build the camera. They'd bring it back. And 99% of the time, it would work perfectly. It was light tight. It was square at the edges. Perfectly built. I give that assignment today, 20 years later, and what comes back, I'm not sure what comes back, but it's not a camera and it doesn't work. It looks more like an alien baby. So to get what we need out of that now, and my commentary here is not about good, bad. I'm indifferent to that. What I'm really interested in is where is it taking us as human beings? What will it mean to be human in the future? And so now that assignment means taking an entire class period, 3 hours, to show students how to hold a ruler, how to push down with the right amount of force, how to hold a utility knife, how to draw that utility knife against the straight edge to get a straight, not wavy line, because then you have to take two corners and bring them together, and they need to be light tight. And it's really a struggle for them. It's really a struggle. Holding the two corners together, using tape to get those corners tightly tucked against each other. So I just became really intrigued by those differences. And I turned to the pinhole camera myself as a way of making work. Because of that, I wanted to do a 180-degree turn away from digital technology, and I wanted to really be physically involved with my work. I wanted to sweat in the studio while making work. And then the body of work that I've been making for the last 10 years came from a merging of that interest, and there is a lot of, if you're out there and you're listening, there's a lot of research being done. There's research in London that shows that young students in elementary, grade students, the muscles in their fingers are developing differently, that they actually cannot hold pencils. They don't have the strength in their fingers to hold the pencil in a way in which they could write or draw with it. It's shifting so many things about what we know with respect to our relationship to physical objects and things. Their sensitivity, to hold an object without breaking it or without bending it. They don't understand that. It's something they're just not familiar with, and I'm intrigued by all that. So all of that interest came together with this collection of glass that I have that came from family, mostly. My parents came here in the 1940s from Sicily. Your classic immigrant story. They had nothing when they arrived. There was opportunity, although it wasn't equal for everyone. There was opportunity to work hard, and they did. I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut. It's a factory town. Stanley Works, the hardware manufacturing, is headquartered there. And they got jobs, and they worked for 40 years, day in and day out, sweating in hot shops, making tape measures and hammers and real work ethics. And after the first 5 or 6 years of being here, when they finally had a little bit of money and started building a family, they bought things they could never have imagined they could have in the past. And they're ordinary things. They're glass cake stands and their bowls and their vases. And they're mid-century, because that's when all of that was happening for them, was in the 50s, essentially, and 60s. And so I'm thinking about all these things about technology, the way it's changing us. I'm looking at this glass collection in my house, and I think I have to do something with this. I have to tell a story about my family's history, but I don't want to just photograph them sort of classic portraits. There's so many ways I could approach it, but I don't want to do that. I want to make work that is less specific somehow, more open to interpretation. And I thought the glass objects could stand in for the family. So they really represent our metaphorical for the family. And that's how it all began. And I've been making it for 10 years, and it has evolved over time and has gone from small to large. And in the meantime, the amount of research I've been doing has grown. And every day I become more and more fascinated by the studies that come out. Artificial intelligence and automation and augmented realities, you know, will we be leading multiple lives in the future? You know, you have your life here on the physical world, and then you go somewhere and sit in a pod and put on some kind of device over your face. And it sounds sci-fi, but it's reality.
Yeah.
And what does that mean? What will we be? Will we evolve to lose the use of fingers? Or what will a relationship be in the future? I'm fascinated. Fascinated.
Wow.
What do your folks think about this work?
They're remarkably overwhelmed by it. You know, they're like, why are you photographing these things? And they didn't understand just how important those things were to me growing up. I idled those things as a child. You know, they didn't have much, and we didn't have much. But as they worked harder and harder, were here longer and longer, they began to have more and more. But they don't think of those things the same way I do. You know, they were just building a life. For me, I see what they had to do through all those objects to get where they are, to have four kids, to put us in the place that we're in now.
You know, your pictures tell a story. What's the important difference that you see in communicating in spoken word versus through, you know, your artwork?
Yeah, that's a great question, because as an artist, you're asked to do many things, and I focus on the making part, but you have to promote your work, you have to write about your work a lot and talk about your work a lot. And I think the difference is, when you walk up to the work, you have this different kind of relationship with it than you do with the spoken word. And I think it's a little, for me, the way I present my work, it's more open. I think my audience can come away with a greater variety of experiences from standing in front of the work rather than listening to me tell them about the work.
You know, one of the most powerful statements I've ever seen about youth crime didn't have a word. It was, I believe, 12 or 13 individual photographs of young women around college age. They're all wearing khakis. They're all wearing, I think, a polo. And half of them are convicted murderers, and half of them are Ivy League students. And the beauty of the exhibit is they never tell you who is who. So 10 years later, I still find my mind reflecting back to the, and it is, it's an amazing story without words.
It kind of stuns you a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I love art, but I don't know how many pieces that I see at a gallery stay with me 10 years later that I reflect back on frequently.
Yeah.
You know, and it's aggravating, but I'm so glad they didn't tell us who was who. You know, because if so, I don't think I would have remembered the exhibit.
The story kind of ends then,
yeah.
Right? You want it to keep telling a story for a long time.
Crystal, what goes through your mind when you were listening to Robert's story?
Oh, I was... There was a study I read about where they talked to people who spoke Romance languages, the Spanish, the French, the Italian, and how they have the opportunity to make things feminine and masculine, like the chair is feminine or the word bridge is masculine. Yeah. And I was wondering, like, when you chose art to represent each family member, was there a feminine and masculine sense, like, this vase is mom versus this vase is dad? And I was just like, I wonder if I could walk through and know when I look at the cake holder that that's his grandma, or, you know, like, the feminine and masculine sense of it. Yeah.
I'm not sure I got that specific with it, but okay. That's fabulous, right? I do have a lot of ideas about making new work that.
But that's a classic example of the audience is going to bring their own thoughts to it that you may not even intend.
Absolutely.
Well, friends, this is Greg Audell, and you are enjoying stories about the many aspects of living as an artist told beautifully by guest storytellers Crystal Ray and Robert Calafiore on So What's Your Story? Only on Houston's KPFT 90.1 FM, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. While we make some announcements, this would be a great time for you to get online and go to kpft.org to make a generous donation that shows your support of this program. And I think we're nearing the end of this pledge drive, you know, so, you know, let's get in while you can, and then you don't have to worry about it. And Tatiana, I know we are the best around, but we are not the only place in town for stories. Would you give us the Houston Storytelling Report for May?
Of course. Well, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, which is a great place to learn about the art of telling. Thanks to its enthusiastic and supportive members, they meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. The next monthly swap will be this coming Tuesday, May 23rd. Make that day the day you become a part of our growing community of storytellers. And be sure to visit the Guild's webpage about upcoming events. And while you're there, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio program. There are close to 500 episodes with more than 2,000 stories.
Get that, 500 episodes.
And if you don't own a radio, that's no problem, because you can listen to us on KPFT and on our Facebook page live. And you can visit us on our own So What's Your Story Facebook page and share it with all of your friends. We'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. And So What's Your Story is also on YouTube, and we really are all over the place. And our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live on this is going to be a place where you will enjoy spectacular stories. The May Moth will meet on the third Tuesday of the month, May 21st, and the theme will be Mama Rules. I promise, once you go to the Moth, it will be one of your favorite things to do. And the So What's Your Story team also wants to hear from you about your program ideas or comments for any one of us. Just, you know, just shoot us an email at story@kpft.org, and I promise we will get back to you.
And we don't just say that. We really do get back to you. And that's how we find some of our fabulous guests.
And Warren, you have anything to say about our fun drive?
This is Warren Holloman. We're here in the middle of Spring Fun Drive. I think we're literally right in the middle of it. It started last week and ends next Thursday. And we are a listener-sponsored radio station, which is a rather unique concept. And what that means is, let's break it down, we're listener-sponsored, literally. If you don't help us out, we don't stay on the air. We don't have funding from other sources, government sources, foundations, whatever. It's from our listeners directly. So we encourage you to call 713-526-5738. We'd like to thank you on the air, if you'll let us. And that's 713-526-5738.
All right. Thank you, Warren. I do hope y'all will log in or call in or let us hear from you. And Tatiana, that was a great job as always. And as with everything you do a great job. And, you know, I am speaking on behalf of all the hosts when I thank you for not only the job you do here, but I want to congratulate you for graduating this coming Saturday with honors from the University of Houston. We are so proud of you. And I'm actually working on a documentary series on the homeless that Tatiana is helping me with. I don't know when she sleeps. I'm convinced she doesn't. But we just couldn't be more proud of what you do on the show and what you've done in school. And I can't wait to see what you do in the future.
Well, thank you. That means so much to me, Greg. It's really been an honor actually being here, and you know, I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, that's not an option. Yeah. When you sign, we're like the mafia. When you sign on with us, you sign on for life. The storytelling mafia. Friends, on Tuesday of this week, I was honored to be the keynote speaker at the annual luncheon for the Lord of the Streets, which is the Episcopal Church's outreach to Houston's homeless residents. If you'd like to make a contribution or volunteer with this outstanding group, just log on to lotshouston.org. And if you'd like to see my talk, we'll have it posted to our Facebook page by hopefully tomorrow. And friends, we are also in for a real treat next week when Warren hosts round two of original stories crafted by those outstanding exchange students that Hank hosted a few weeks back. You asked for them to be on again, and the team at So What's Your Story never disappoints. So thanks to host parent and our very dear friend and a fantastic storyteller in his own right, Paul Topekian, for collecting the kids before the school year is up, and they disperse to do astonishing things in every single corner of the world. Do not miss it, folks. They are special, and you will want to be here to hear them on that one night only. Now, I also want to give kudos to one of my favorite storytellers in Houston, which is our very own Dr. Warren Holloman. And one of my favorite stories of his is going to be on the National Moth Program on May the 25th. I'm not sure if that's a Saturday or Sunday, or they may play them both Saturday and Sunday.
In Houston, it's on KUHF on Saturday at noon.
Saturday at noon. You will not want to miss it.
A week from Saturday, the 25th.
And it's a real honor to be on the Moth program because, you know, there are hundreds of stations, and they go through thousands of stories, and I couldn't be more proud. And, Warren, I'm wondering if you have a little taste of a story that you could share with our audience.
Sure. I thought it might be appropriate. Well, let me give you just a snapshot of the story they'll play next week and then connect that to the one we'll play now. The one next week is about this once-in-a-lifetime experience I had of my wife and I giving birth to our first child at the same time that one of our best friends and next-door neighbor was dying of AIDS. This was back in 1988, the middle of the AIDS epidemic. And it was just a time I'll never forget. So that's the story that will be on next week. The story we thought we'd play tonight is one that was aired on the radio about 5 or 6 years ago. And it's called The Briar Patch. And it's about my first visit to a gay bar. Tatiana?
Usually don't come together. Well, it was about 20 years ago, and I was taking a class at University of Houston, and the assignment was to film a series of role plays, family role plays. And most students recruited other classmates to do the role plays. But I had a friend who was an actor, or at least a former actor, and I thought, wow, mine could be really good if I would recruit him.
So we're having some technical problems, so I'm going to try to pick it up from there live. My assignment was to organize some role plays of family situations involving conflicts. And the other students recruited other students for the role plays. But I had this friend who was a real actor. He had been on plays in Houston. He'd been in movies. If you saw the North Dallas 40, he played the Catholic chaplain in that movie. He was a great actor, but he was near the end of his life. He was retired, he was in poor health, and he was in poor financial situation as well. So I thought, well, if I could recruit Grant to be in my role play, it would be the best one in the class. Plus, it would give me an excuse to pay him something to help him with his financial difficulties. So we did the role play and went really well. I mean, really well. Grant kind of stole the show. And after we videotaped it, I got my wallet out and I said, Grant, I owe you big time. He paused and said, well, you know what I'd really like is don't pay me anything, but take me out for a couple of beers. I said, okay. It was Tuesday night at 10:30. I had two young children, and, you know, I was thinking about needing to get to bed, but he did a big favor. So I said, yes. We headed down Greenbrier Avenue, and if you're from Houston, from my age demographic, well, you'll kind of figure out where we were going. Just before Holcomb, we turned left into the parking lot, and that was the site of the Briar Patch, which was Houston's first gay bar. Since this was 1995 or so, 1994, by then there were other gay bars, but this is the one the older men preferred. So we got out of the car and started walking toward the Briar Patch. As we walked in there, Grant kind of grabbed my arm, and he had this twinkle in his eye. And little did I know, but just as I had recruited him to do some improvisational role plays for me, he was designing on the spot an improvisational role play in which he was in his mid-70s, would be this aging, rather queenish gay man with his young lover. I was still in my 30s. And we entered that bar, and he was holding on to my elbow and introducing me to all of his friends. And he knew I was very happily married. He was good friends with my wife. But for the next 2 hours, we were in a role play. And he introduced me to his friends. I could barely see them. The bar was dark. That was intentionally, because at that point, men still wanted their privacy. And there was so much cigarette smoke. It was a piano bar. And at a given moment, the pianist started playing songs, and the men gathered around the piano, and they started playing Broadway show tunes. And all the men sang the songs. They knew all the words to all the songs. I tried to pretend that I knew the words, but I was not so good at that. But I found myself just loving the camaraderie and the spirit of love and fellowship that I found there. And at one point, they sang a song that they dedicated to me. It was from a show tune about an older man with his younger lover. And they changed it from girlfriend to boyfriend. And I had to sit on the piano, and everybody sort of sang to me. And it was a lot of fun. But then they stopped playing the Broadway show tunes. And they started playing, and I know you won't believe this. By the way, a little background. I grew up in a Baptist church, and for us, there were bar people and there were church people, and I'd never even hardly been in a bar in my life. Well, they started playing, of all things, Baptist hymns. I kid you not, Baptist hymns. And I knew all the words to those songs. But the words, for the first time, began to mean something. When they sang "Just As I Am" without one plea, the idea that God accepts me just as I am, those men understood the theology behind that song. And when they sang "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound," there was a sweetness to that that I had never heard in any other place. And I began to realize, I'm in a real church now. These songs are starting to make sense. The concept of grace and community and love made sense. And then he played one more song. It sounded like a hymn, but I couldn't place it. And in time, I realized he was playing the tune of "A Place for Us" from the Broadway play West Side Story. That song was written about a boy who was Puerto Rican and a girl who was Italian, or vice versa, and how they could never be who they truly were and love who they truly loved because of prejudice. But those men had... that song really spoke to those men as well. And they sang that song like a hymn. The words haunt me to this day. There's a place for us, somewhere a place for us. Take my hand, I'll take you there. Hold my hand, we're almost there. Somewhere, somehow, some way. That was one of the last times I was with my friend Grant. He died a few months later. He was in poor health after that. But I'll always be grateful to him, because I felt like he showed me that place. In that moment, I saw heaven and what a real church was in that bar.
Well, friends, that is why Warren Holloman will be featured on the National Moth Story Hour, because he is one of the best storytellers in this town. And you'll want to hear the story that will air. But that is so touching, Warren.
And for the younger listeners, you have to understand that was a time when gay men basically were not allowed to go to most churches. So they had created a church in that bar, literally.
Wow. Wow, you always leave me with something to think about, Warren. Thank you very much, and thank you for being on this program.
Yeah.
I always enjoyed having you on.
Thanks.
Well, Crystal, your next story is tough. And Warren's a tough act to follow. I know. That's why I won't be telling a story tonight. And I'll tell you what, actually, before we get to that, let me thank our very, very dear friend, Eric, for his generous contribution. Thank you very much. And you are also a great part of the storytelling community. And it doesn't say if I can say your last name, so I'm going to. Eric Keene, who you will often hear on this show. And tune in when you get a chance, because he is also a wonderful storyteller. So, Crystal, your next story is tough, but it is an important one. Will you tell us your next story?
Yeah, the kind of the concept of this play, it's a one-man play, so I actually won't be putting it on. I wrote it. I kind of channel my dad for some of those sounds to get my testosterone going. But the story is that of a family who has lost their daughter in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing of 1969. And so I've kind of created a fictional world for him as he struggles through what it means to have lost his daughter and not have gotten the justice he was so desperately hoping for. And here we go. We don't go to that church no more. I mean, they built it back up, but we ain't go back. My oldest daughter, only older by a few months, she's got all the markings of being born first. She never wants us helping, always looking down the road to what's next. Only time she ain't that way is on Sunday. Now, on Sunday, she holds my hand. I thought she was doing it for me, because I don't want to be in nobody's pew. I don't want to be singing. I don't want to be preached at. And I tell my wife and baby girl to go to the bathroom before we leave, because we ain't going to be staying there going to the bathroom there. So they're going to have to hold it. And the second you can't hold it, we coming home. They don't fight me on it, though. I mean, they scared of the bathroom, too. Which means we leave church most times during the altar call, which be another 2 hours anyway. 2 hours of altar calling. I get mad if I spend 2 seconds waiting on someone to answer when I'm calling. You calling for 2 hours. Ain't nobody home. Hang up. The only reason I'm going is because last time I didn't go, I lost the ocean. And what a man do if he lose the ocean and dry land? So I go, but I don't want to. And I thought that's why my oldest holds my hand. And we were maybe there 3 or 4 months into going into this new church. And we were leaving early like we do. And just as we crossed the threshold onto the sidewalk, I see my baby girl breathe out. Which made me think back through the whole service. I mean, she had my hand the whole 2 hours. And as the time went on, she squeezed my hand tighter and tighter till she was near crushing me. I know, because every Sunday my hand is throbbing for at least an hour after the service. She crushing me like she's holding her breath, like she's underwater. And first thing I can't figure out is how in the world is she not breathing for 2 hours? I mean, ain't no Negro sermon shorter than 2 hours. And how come I ain't noticed she don't breathe no more? And she ain't been breathing for months. So Sunday come again, and this time I'm ready. Before we leave, I take my oldest and I set her on that table and I look at her so that we right here, eye to eye. And I did for my 11-year-old girl the same thing I used to do for them kids who was paying me to interpret their dreams. I looked her right in her eye and I lied. I told her, God said in a dream, he said, tell your daughter I have sent 3 angels to her home. And I say to the Lord, thank you, Lord. Is that one for me, one for my wife, and one for my baby girl? And the Lord said to me, no, they all for your baby girl. And God told me to tell you, when you're running out of air, shout hallelujah, and the air will come rushing in. So we walk into that little church, and we sat where we sit, and my oldest daughter's grip is on my hand, and it's starting to get tight. And I'm watching her, and I see she ain't breathing. And so I pointed to the corner where ain't nobody standing, and I say, there one is right there, right there. You see him? He a big joker, taller than me. And he frowning. He ready. The second you give him the signal, he ready. And she look over, and she squint, and she is wringing my hand to death. And it's quiet because they praying over communion. And she roars from the bottom of her little soul, hallelujah! And the room is stunned because Negroes got a time and a place for hollering. They like for you to wait till the organ is going or for the choir to be singing or for the preaching to be high. A couple of folks ran out the building because they thought it was getting bombed. And my baby girl is roaring. And the ushers are making a beeline over to her because ushers got control issues. And I'm not going to let her fight for air all by herself. So I stand up and she jump up on the pew. And she almost as tall as me. And we both hallelujahed until my wife went into a fit of a dance. She whirled like a chocolate colored helicopter. Arms for blades, dress bouncing, head flinging. People are diving out of the way. And heaven shoved itself into that tiny little church. And sent the whole congregation into this beautiful hysteria. And in the middle of tambourines and clapping and ecstasy, my baby girl grabs my face and she say, look, Daddy, I'm breathing. Hallelujah.
Wow. What a powerful story. How did this story come to you?
Actually, another artist approached me about wanting a one-man play. He had come to a one-woman play I'd put on, and he was like, I won't want to. And he wanted to tell the story of fathers, and this was one of the storylines, was I want to be the dad of one of the four little girls who were murdered in that. And he moved on to other art, as artists do, but I was stuck. I wanted to finish it, and so...
I'm telling you, you clearly have a lot of people living inside of you.
As long as they make me money, I'm all right with it. But the second they start costing them a change, they go.
Wow. Well, I would think they would all make you money. I'd like to meet all of them one day. And friends, you may not realize that KPFT was founded by and continues to be supported by the very most important people in Houston, Texas. They are called volunteers, and they are called contributors. And to join this very impressive group, the entry is manageable. All you have to do is call 713-526-5738, and you can make a one-time contribution, or you can make a monthly contribution. Any way that works for you, it will mean a lot to us. You can also go to kpft.org and choose So What's Your Story is the program you'd like to support, and make your donation that way. And I want to thank my guests for spending this hour with us. And, you know, in case you'd like to find out a little bit more about these good folks, Robert, where can people see your show, and where can they discover more of your work?
So I'm in Houston because I have a solo show at Photo Relevance. I met the owners, Bryn Larson and Jeffrey Kosloff, in Portland, Oregon, a couple years ago, and they've been gracious enough to bring my work to Houston and to represent me here in Houston now. And so Photo Relevance Gallery is at 616 Hawthorne Street, and the opening and reception for the exhibition is tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. I hope you'll stop by. And besides that, visit robertcalafiore.com.
All right. And I'll tell you, I'm going to be at the opening. I encourage everyone within the sound of my voice to be there because I think it's going to be a good time. And Crystal, where can our audiences find you?
www.crystalrayproductions.com.
Now, let's say that one more time.
crystalrayproductions.com, and
all
Ray
right.
is R-A-E.
R-A-E. Well, friends, do we have anyone else to thank, Warren?
Not yet.
So you got about 5 more minutes to get in, my friends, whether you do it online, whether you call and talk to Woodson, who is kind enough to donate his time. And we've got a room full of volunteers that are sitting there volunteering their time, and they would absolutely love to talk to you. And, Warren, we're looking forward to seeing your radio program on the MOF. Tatiana, we can't wait for you to graduate. That is just awesome. Now, friends, don't you dare move, because Lars and the Tennyson tapes. Excuse me?
I believe we have 5 more minutes, Greg.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
One of the reasons we that one of the things that's unique about our show is that we bring you artists like the ones you've heard tonight from all over the map. A couple of weeks ago, we had a theater artist. We represented the AD players, the ensemble, Fourth Wall. Tonight, we've got a solo artist, Crystal Ray, who performer who's also performing with the ensemble right now in a play.
Yeah, understudy.
That she could tell us about.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, right now they've got Pipeline Up, a beautiful story about what it means for the school system to not support students and what happens when those students get funneled into the prison system. I know as educators, that is such an important topic. And so I'm glad Ensemble's tackling that. And then coming up, Josephine Baker. So if you're in the mood to shimmy and wear your boa and get some feathers.
When and where?
Let's go.
Well, I'm not saying anything about the boa, but I'd like to see the show.
Come through. It's going to be at the Ensemble too. It's going to be their next show. So I'm excited to see it. And the young woman who is doing the show, oh my God, talent in a capsule. It's going to be phenomenal. So bring your tap shoes, bring your dance shoes, bring something to shake your butt. It's going to be a great time.
And the cat.
And I did want to tip my hat, actually, to the late Tim Conway, who passed this week.
Yes.
You know, regular listeners of this show know that I was a sort of an obsessive stalker as a child. So when I was 13 years old, I was getting ready to walk out the door to go meet Ray Charles and interview him for the first time when my phone rang, and it was Tim Conway returning my call because I wanted to interview him. And I had to say, Mr. Conway, I'd really like to talk to you, but I'm going out the door to talk to Ray Charles. He goes, I'll tell you what, can you give me 10 minutes? I said, okay, I've got 10 minutes. So for years, I had a cassette with an interview with Tim Conway on one side and Ray Charles on the other. And I just got to say, he was the nicest guy, you know.
Yes.
And I later learned he had 8 children, and it made total sense to me. He knew how much it would mean to a 13-year-old to talk to him. And I thought, what a class act. What a class act.
That's amazing.
One thing I wanted to add about on to what Crystal Ray was saying is that just by coincidence, I think 3 of the artists in the ensemble production have been on this show in the past year.
Yes. Regina and, Curtis Vaughn.
Vaughn was on last year doing a monologue. And then Rachel Dixon is the director.
Yeah, she is. And she's phenomenal. She's one of the people I have look at my words and tell me things don't make sense. Yeah, she's
everybody needs an editor.
Thank you.
She's quite sharp. And then the other thing I wanted to point out, just sitting here on the other side of the booth listening, is the location of Robert's exhibit. If you're not familiar with Hawthorne Street, it's literally just one block from this studio. So if you know where KPFT is, just park in this area and you can walk and be there.
I'd love to see you there.
Awesome.
All right, friends. Well, now don't you dare move, because Lars is indeed up next with the Tennyson tapes. And for those that listened on my last show, we got to sit in for Lars, and it was a lot of fun doing music for an hour. That's something we haven't done. Lars shares a sweet mix of singer-songwriters, and he'll be up shortly. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell, along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.